Good morning. It's been a nice week, hasn't it? It's been amazing. But my suntan is from my holiday, not from this week, just so you know, because I've been back to work this week. I did get a suntan in Wales, actually, which is a minor achievement, isn't it, Wayne? Just to draw your attention to this science event, we've got this, the current president of the Baptist Union coming to visit us in mid-May. And he's a scientist by profession. He's actually a meteorologist, I believe. And we're going to have a weekend of science events, Wow Science on Saturday, and he'll be here on the Sunday morning, and we'll have lunch with him afterwards. And then a service at 2 o'clock on that Sunday with him, Dr. David Gregory, and Professor Andrew Steen, who might be in the room still somewhere. So look forward to that. So do bear that in mind. It's coming up, and it's on our website on the homepage, and feel free to share that on social media or whatever. It should be a great event. So we're starting a new sermon series this morning. We're looking at the book of Ruth together. Ruth has how many chapters?
Four.
And this is a four-week sermon series, but we're not exactly following the four chapters chronologically. We are going to look at four of the themes that come out of Ruth. Having said that, I will be saying a fair bit about chapter one this morning and setting the scene. But Ruth is set in the time of the Judges. The Judges was that sort of sandwiched between the arrival into Canaan under Joshua and then that sort of slightly more promising time that begins with Saul and David and Solomon and so on. So it's a period of the Judges. It's an interesting time in the Bible because you've got your high points. You've got Gideon and Deborah and Barak and not sure if you should mention Samson. He was a very mixed character, Samson. But generally, the picture in Judges, if you look at it, is of social disintegration, oppression, idolatry, sexual immorality, and war. It's a very bleak time in Israel's history. And people have recognized that there is a cycle that keeps going round in the Judges from one to the next. The people turn from God, and then God judges them by delivering into the hands of their enemies, and then the people turn back to God. And so God sends a judge in answer to their prayers to rescue them, and then there is a period of peace, and then once they're comfortable again, they turn from God. And that happens time and again in the book of Judges. And so you can imagine that actually, when we come to Ruth, Ruth is like this sort of shining light that comes out of this time. It's a really good story. And I think one of the reasons it's a good story is because it's about ordinary people. Judges is full of those rulers and leaders and a lot of the Bible, kings and so on. But actually, Ruth is about a pretty ordinary family who go through a tragic time and then God redeems them and he turns things around for them. So I don't know if you came to church feeling very ordinary. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we lose our mojo, don't we? For those of you who remember that expression, we feel very plain. But I want to encourage you that actually God wants to take us as ordinary people, the things that are not great in some ways, and make us into something extraordinary. He takes us as natural people and he fills us with himself, and we become not merely natural, but also there is something supernatural about us. So if we have God in us, I'm not sure we should be calling our lives ordinary. Okay, so here is a picture of what God does to the ordinary, let's say. So we'll have a look at this and go through it. So disaster looms in verses 1 and 2 here. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were, shall we say this one together? That's very good. Ephrathites. I mix up my THs and Ps and everything. All right, from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Okay, so we read here there's a famine in the land. In fact, specifically Bethlehem is mentioned. That's ironic because Bethlehem's a very fertile area. I've been to Bethlehem. Things were growing everywhere. And the very name Bethlehem means house of bread. So there's an irony here that there is no bread. They're in famine. And so Elimelech decides to uproot his family. And he heads to Moab, which was about 50 miles to the southeast, although I think that journey by foot would have been longer than that. And here's our question. Why did Elimelech go to the land of Moab? Why go there? He's in Bethlehem, and he is voluntarily taking himself and his family to a foreign land who was hostile to Israel. The chief god of the Moabites was a god called Chemosh, and Chemosh was a god who demanded child sacrifice. Not a very pleasant deity in that sense. Why go there of all places? And in fact, because of the Moabites' treatment of the Israelites, God had said that they were not permitted into Jewish worship. We read here in Deuteronomy, "No Ammonite or Moabite or any of their descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord, not even in the 10th generation, for they did not come to meet you with bread and water on your way when you came out of Egypt." So why go there? Why go there? Why not stay in Bethlehem and trust God? I'm sure a lot of the other people did that. We'll pray, we'll seek God's face, but Elimelech doesn't do that. So I want to suggest that he made a mistake. Now, you might not agree with me. It doesn't say Elimelech made a mistake, but I suspect he did. And why did he do this? Well, I think it's worth us remembering. You know, we think of the Jewish nation as fantastic monotheists. They believed in one God. The truth is, they were often in their history much closer to polytheism, worshipping many gods. They worshipped God, Yahweh, Jehovah, but also they were so, that the worship of the other gods of the Canaanites, they were always so close, for never far from that. Now, you notice in the Bible that they often turned back to God when they faced enemies. And I think one of the reasons for that is because they knew that Yahweh could deliver them from their enemies, because he'd done that many times, and not least from Egypt, okay? So if they got an enemy, let's worship Yahweh. He'll deliver us because he can do that. It reminds me when I lived in India, and I discovered there that there is a God for everything. And I was amazed to find there's a God for bodybuilding. So if you wanted, that's right, isn't it? So if you wanted, then you would worship. Do you know the name of that one, Stephen? Evidently not. I mean, you do. You used to. Sorry, I'll take that one back later. My apologies. There's a God, if you're poor, there's a God you can worship to get money. Is that Lakshmi? Or she's beauty and wealth, isn't she, Lakshmi? Okay. There's a God for everything. Now, I wonder, you see, Elimelech, he's surrounded by these Canaanite nations, and their gods are fertility gods, they're agricultural gods. Maybe he's thinking, oh, there's a famine, so maybe if I go and worship the fertility gods, maybe they'll answer the prayers, because that's what we need right now. Who knows? I don't know. I don't want to judge the guy. Presumably, I might meet him in heaven one day. I don't want to get it wrong, but maybe he made a mistake here, but even if he did make a mistake, the great thing is we see in this story how God redeems it. He redeems it. He brings something good from Elimelech's perhaps slightly dodgy move to Moab. And I want us to be encouraged by that God can deal with our mistakes. He can bring good from them. You know, we know God blesses us when we do what is right, but even when we make mistakes, God can turn that around. He can use mistakes as the raw material to bring a new sense of blessing for us. God has a plan. He always has a plan for us. Sometimes we have our own plans and they're different, and we choose our own plans for a while. That doesn't mean God doesn't have a plan anymore. He might adjust his plan, but he always has a plan, and it is always good. Right, disaster strikes, verses 3 to 5. Now Elimelech Naomi's husband died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. We're not told here how Naomi's husband and sons died, presumably not of starvation. The others survived. But they died, and if you think about it, that left Naomi in an awfully precarious position. There's no sort of social services back then. She was a widow now with no one to protect her, no one to defend her. She has no male heir to carry on the family line. She has no male to guarantee her inheritance back in Israel, where she may have still had land or property. And she's in Moab. She is, you know, all the time in the Old Testament, God says, look after the alien and the poor and the widow and the stranger. And there's a sense in which Naomi is all of those things. She is powerless, she's nameless, she's stateless, and she's penniless. So she decides to go home. Verse 6 to 7. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. And then we find that one goes. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me. At this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. So they're here, they're on the road to Judah. Naomi has urged them both to return home. They're probably still young. Most of the commentators think they're in their 20s. And they had every prospect of a new life with new husbands. And initially refusing, Orpah in the end did go home, but Ruth, we are told, clung to her. And I want to pick two phrases from the verses we've just seen to highlight what I hope is the heart of today's message. Because our title today, if you notice at the beginning, was Ruth, Perspectives on Despair and Hope. Perspectives on Despair and Hope. And I think that we find both despair and hope in Naomi here. And here are the two phrases that I think pull this out for us. Hope. She says in verse 8, and beyond that, may the Lord show you kindness. And then also despair. The Lord's hand has turned against me. So let's look at despair first. The Lord's hand has turned against me. Have you ever felt like that? Ever felt that God is not quite in your corner in the way you thought he should be, that he's against you in some sense? I think it's very easy for us to feel that way, you know, when we go through a time of prolonged ill health, it's very hard sometimes to hold on to the sense God is with us. When we undergo bereavement, which Naomi had done three times in this story, maybe a particularly difficult time at work, maybe the future's just not unfolding the way that we imagined it would and our version of what is good. I think it's very easy for us to feel this. We may not say it out loud, but that the Lord's hand is against us. Now, you could say in a sense Naomi's been a bit unfair on God here, because there's no indication in the text that God was judging Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion. That it's not that God killed them, they just died. Nor are we told that God sent them to Moab in the first place. So maybe she's been a bit unfair, but actually, I think Naomi's words are true here because she understands herself as God's child. You know, we talk about God as sovereign. We talk of his providence, his providence. He provides for us. Jesus told us to approach God as Father. And one of the things of that is that gives us duties as children to act in a certain way towards God, but it also puts duties on God to care for us and to provide for us because we're his sons and daughters. And so I think it is quite reasonable, as Naomi does here, at times, for us to cry out, "Why, Lord? Why? What are you doing? I don't understand anymore. What is going on here?" All those interrogatives we can bring of why and when and where and all those sorts of things. And we've seen this before here, that this way of speaking to God is far more common in the Bible than it is in our church, at least in our public worship. It's that language, isn't it, of lament, that language of protest. Again, I mentioned this before, but one person called this sort of way of speaking to God the language of loyal opposition. It's opposition because it says, "God, what are you doing? Don't understand." But it's also loyal because it says, "God, what are you doing?" It doesn't leave God. It doesn't break the relationship. It just changes it. And we come almost, in a sense, as God's accuser, and say, "God, I don't understand anymore." But it's all within the relationship. That language of lament is within that relationship. So Naomi feels despair, but as we'll see in a moment, she also holds on to a sense of God's goodness because she sees that there's a bigger picture. Now, I've been reflecting on this week, and the way that our culture sometimes tells us to live compared to God's wisdom, and I've sort of summed it up. Yes, it's a generalization, okay, but maybe this is something of the choice we're called to make. We can live by what feels good now, or we can live, always live, by what is true. And what I want to say is I think we need to be careful as Christians that we don't live purely in the moment and that we don't live purely by emotion. Don't live purely in the moment, don't live purely by emotion. Living in the emotion of the moment is a pig of a problem. It's the problem of immediate gratification. And don't look at that pig on the right. It'll freak you out if you look at him for too long. You see, if we live... Just stop looking at the pig now, yeah? If we live purely in the moment, then we will be constantly evaluating who God is by what's happening right now. And sometimes that may be great. God's good because life is good. But sometimes when life is difficult, we would then come to the conclusion, God's not so good after all. He's not as good as I thought he was. This is the problem. And so what I want to say is, and I think this comes across from Ruth 1, the Christian life has to be lived in three tenses. We have to live our Christian lives in the tenses of past, present, and future. Naomi's present is awful right now. But I believe she knows the past. She knows the God that she has served. She knows that he is a God who has delivered Israel from her enemies time and time again. And I believe she looks to the future as well. You know, right now, Naomi can't see a future for herself. She sees her life as basically over, as ended. But she still holds on to a sense of future for her daughters-in-law, for Orpah and Ruth. There is a future. May you know God's kindness. Even though I haven't, may you know it. So she can still see ahead. And so I think for us as Christians, we have to live in three tenses. We have to remember the past. What God has done in history. Supremely, the fact that God sent his son, and Jesus the son willingly came and voluntarily laid down his life for us because of God's love for us. You know, if God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not forego laying down his son, how much more will he not graciously give us all things? You know, if we are ever in doubt at any point in our lives because of our circumstances about God's love, let's look back to the past, to that moment, that definitive statement that God has made, that this is how much you're worth to me. This is how much you're worth. So we look back to the past. And also, we look back to the past in terms of what God has done in our own lives. Our Ebenezers, to use that sort of jargony word. But, a biblical word. Last weekend, we weren't here, but we were in Oxford. But I was on annual leave. And I'm sorry, but I thought, I'm not going to go to HBC. So we went to St. Leonard's in Aynsham. But the reason we went there is because there's the vicar there is called Duncan Fraser, and Duncan used to come here with Carmen and Caleb and Scarlett while he was training at Wycliffe. They let him, which is nice, because we're a Baptist church. Had a good chat to him afterwards, and he was talking very much about the value of the sacraments, obviously getting a bit Anglican there, but the value of the sacraments, and specifically the Lord's Supper and baptism. And the point he was making, which I think is very helpful, is that the Lord's Supper reminds us what God has done for us, and baptism reminds us what we've done for God. You know, that we need to look back to those key points, those decision-making points in our lives. And we look forwards with trust in God. And we have to do that because a lot of what we're going through will not make sense in the present tense. A lot of our difficulties will only make sense in the light of future glory. And that's just the way it is. So our confidence, in other words, as Christians, is not just to be in, oh, what's God doing right now in my life, but what has God done and what is God going to do? And we have to hold on to that. And very close to this is that temptation as Christians to be too much led by our emotions. Anyone here a fan of Myers-Briggs? Myers-Briggs. Hey, of course you are. You work with Myers-Briggs, don't you, Aaron? There's a few of us. If you're a fan, or if at least you're not Andrew, okay. If at least you know it, one of my four letters is F, and that means I'm a feeling person. So I sadly make a lot of my decisions by my heart, a little bit more than my head. It's a good thing. And there's nothing wrong with that. Probably about half the population are like that. But I recognize there can be dangers also in that way, that you have to watch that way of thinking sometimes. And the one thing I've learned, I think, as I've got older, is not to take my feelings too seriously, particularly the negative ones, because they will terrorize you if you're not careful. There's a story of an Eastern king, and he once charged his wise men to write a sentence for him, a phrase, a motto that would be true in all circumstances and for every age and stage of life. And they wrote a fantastic motto. It's four words long. Does anyone know what it is? Excellent. This too shall pass. This too shall pass. Brilliant. Well done. As Christians, we have those emotionally high moments, those spring harvest moments, if I dare call them that, okay? And that's great. There's nothing wrong with high moments. This is why we go on holiday, isn't it? To have those high. This is why we celebrate birthdays. We have high moments. But we can't live in those high moments all the time. In fact, I wasn't going to say this, so I better be quick, but for a number of years, I deliberately stopped going to Spring Harvest because I knew I couldn't live on the emotion of Spring Harvest. And so what was the point? So I had to live a Christian life that was sustainable without those high points. Of course, that was a silly way to think because we do need high points in life. They're helpful for us. But at the same time, we shouldn't live always in the emotion of the low moments. Of course, we feel emotion. I'm not saying we shouldn't. But let's not let that absolutely dominate us. What is vital for us as Christians is to live by not just what we feel, but by what is true. And I think if our emotions can line up with what is true and rejoice in what is true, then we will be onto a really good thing. You know, Job got to the point where in chapter 13 of Job, he can say, what can he say? Even though he slay me, yet will I trust him. I love Psalm 42 and 43, that refrain. Why, my soul, are you downcast? Why so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God, for I will yet praise him, my Savior and my God. You know, that psalmist, the writer of that psalm, is going through a really difficult time. But he speaks to his emotions. He actually rebukes his emotions and educates his emotions. And I think we need to be doing some of this in our lives sometimes. And Naomi's able to hold on to that sense of God's goodness. She utters a prayer for Orpah and Ruth, asking God to show his kindness to them. She clearly knows that God is still good. Yeah, she knows God is still good. Here's a lovely quotation I came across this week by somebody called P. Forster. What you believe or do not believe about prayer is a good guide to your belief in general. What you believe about prayer is an indication of what you believe about God. More particularly, what you do about prayer is an indication of what you believe about it. So, I'm just going to leave that there for a second. I found that quite searching. But you see, with Naomi, for all the difficulties, she prays for Orpah and Ruth. She still has that fundamental bedrock confidence that God is good. She knows that her life has become bitter. She feels God's hand has gone out against her, but she prays for God's kindness to them. Kindness, that word kindness that she uses here is the word hesed, which is that very highest word to describe God's relationship to us in the Old Testament. It speaks of God's steadfast love and faithfulness. Someone described it as the warmth of God's fellowship and the security of God's faithfulness. I think where we need to get to is to the point where our confidence is in who God is. Yes, what he's done in the past. Yes, what he'll do in the future. But even more fundamentally than that, the confidence of who he is. So I just want us to reflect on that. Are you absolutely committed to your belief in the goodness of God? Are you persuaded and convinced that God only has good plans for you? He's not out to make your life horrible or terrible or to see you meet a tragic end. God wants good things for you. Yes, we live in a fallen world and all that, and that's not God's fault. But within that, God has great plans for us. So we need that conviction. Over the past 2 weeks, we went on holiday to the Gower. Anyone been to the Gower? Yay. And on the second day there, I took Breeze and the girls on a walk. I said, it's a 4 mile walk. Anyone know that beach? Yeah, Rasili. I said, look, it's 2 miles down this beach and 2 miles back. But I said, where I want to get to isn't this beach. It's round the corner. Whitford Sands. So it's absolutely amazing. It's bigger, wider than this beach, like double the width. So I said, we've got to get to Whitford Sands. So off we set. And I discovered, actually, that the beach is not 2 miles long. It's 3 miles long. And that when we got to the end, that Whitford Sands wasn't round the corner, but there was a headland we had to climb, and then a bay, and then another bay. So that's the Gower, and the yellow arrows are what we did. And it was a 12-mile walk. Sort of had trouble regaining confidence in them after that for the holiday with my... with my daily plans. The exercise was good though, wasn't it? But you know, sometimes our Christian walk can feel a bit like this, can't it? You know, we know there's something good and we have a sense something good around the corner. It's taken an awfully long time to get there. It's a bit like this. Is Barbara here? Yeah. This is a prayer labyrinth. Nick set up prayer spaces at St. Andrew's School this week, and Barbara's very happy here because she's got to the centre of the labyrinth, although I suspect she walked straight across it. But this labyrinth, you're supposed to walk around it slowly, and it reminds you of the twists and turns of life and what might look like dead ends, where you seem to be going back on yourself, when you want to go to the centre, but the path is actually taking you away from the centre, and so on. And I think our Christian journey can feel an awfully lot like that sometimes. We know, God, there's a quicker way, surely. It's just over there. But sometimes we go through these paths. Sometimes it's because of life and our fallenness and the world's fallenness. And sometimes God leads us through difficult times for his own purposes because we know that suffering can bring things from us that comfort can't. It's a bit like a bear hunt, isn't it? Sometimes in life we can't go over it, we can't go under it. Oh no! God, go through it. But God's plans are good. And we see his plans being good in the very last part here of the chapter. We've just seen one goes, but also one stays. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. See, there's a sense here that Naomi can't feel God's embrace, but she can feel Ruth. Ruth is there for her. We're told Ruth clung to her. That verb is the same verb from Genesis 2:24, which speaks of the fundamental bond of marriage. Ruth is making an incredible statement. "I am your family. I will always be your family." She even says, "May God deal with me if I don't live up to this." And I like to think that actually, when God feels far away to Naomi, that Ruth brings God close. I believe Ruth is a minister of God to Naomi, that Ruth is God's gift to Naomi. But I also believe Naomi is God's gift to Ruth, because actually it's through Naomi that Ruth finds the true and living God. Just finish with the homecoming. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. I love that. Naomi left Bethlehem in famine, and she arrived as the barley harvest was beginning. There is a sense of a new beginning here for her. Naomi feels her life is bitter. You know, the word Naomi, the name, and names, of course, are very important though in those days. And it means pleasant or lovely. She says, "Don't call me, I'm not pleasant or lovely anymore. Call me Mara," which means bitterness. But as we'll see in the coming 3 weeks, Naomi's life, yes, it was a journey from blessing to bitterness, but also from bitterness back to blessing. I think it's next week we'll hear about the kinsman redeemer. Is it? Might be. We'll have to wait and see. But God provides a kinsman redeemer for Naomi so that Ruth can remarry and carry on Naomi's line. So the future's not over. And then we come to the very end. So, Kath, this is first line, last line, okay? This is going right to the end, last line almost. Because Ruth and Boaz have a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son." And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Isn't that amazing? Naomi has a son. And Naomi is holding in her hands the grandfather of King David. And who else was in the line of David? Jesus. God is redeeming. He's redeeming with a small r here, but he's also redeeming with a capital R. This is his salvation coming to all of us. Now, I think it's true to say in the rest of the book of Ruth that Ruth and Boaz probably take center stage. But Naomi in the book becomes the interpreter of events. She's the one who says to Ruth, "I think this is what God is doing." And she interprets what happens in the light of God's goodness and providence. So the last line is a good line. And we're going to sing a song now. Maybe the band can come up. I'm going to sing a song which I hope will call us to confidence in, not necessarily what you think God is doing in your life right now, but confidence in who God is. It's that song, Good, Good Father. Let's stand, shall we, and sing this together.